Saturday the 14th of December, Las Vegas, Nevada. Consistently above average is here, on location, on the road. It is 9:30 Irish time, which means it is 1:30 Las Vegas time. Initially thought I was going to record this episode really early, but I wanted to go down to the venue this morning because Sam McNally and Gareth Vaughan were both competing very early on. So I wanted to go down and watch them. So we're back here now. We are back here now in the hotel. What a couple of days. Stress levels were through the roof the day or so before heading to Vegas. We had a minor catastrophic error involving a middle of the night innocuous and a very innocent sip of a can of Pepsi Max that ended up spilling all over my bed, spilling all over my phone. And yeah, phone's dead. Phone's currently in Dublin being repaired. Was sent from the repair shop in Dundalk. We'll talk about it all. But this, the last day in Vegas, was down the black belt matches are happening at the moment. And if you can hear them noises in the background, it's because I learned how to put iMessage on my laptop. And that was because I thought I would be here without a phone. So the black belt finals are happening at the minute. I dipped back here to be able to record this, to get it done. Where do we start? Let's go back to breaking the phone. All right, broke the phone a day and a half before I went away. Brought it to the shop. That was okay. Got the screen replaced. That seemed to be what the problem was. And then it kept turning off every 3 or 5 minutes. So not ideal going with a phone like that abroad that was wonky on its way out. And the thought of landing here with no phone, no Uber, no Revolut, no ability to contact anyone, that really not the most ideal situation. Now, Aaron, who helped me out in the phone repair shop in Dundalk, I'm going to send as much business as possible to this man, first of all. I already told him, fix the phone fully. There's the cash for that. Let's get the motherboard replaced. Let's tidy it up. Let's make it look like a new phone again. I'm even considering breaking people's phones so that I could... How do I mute this? Oh my goodness. All of these iMessages are coming in at once. And mute for 1 hour. Okay, there we go. Live podcasting, ladies and gentlemen. I'm considering breaking people's phones and pretend it was by accident, just so I can keep recommending that they go to fix them from his shop. This man is an absolute legend. Helped make the trip happen, first and foremost. And like, I always have this sort of fear before traveling away. So if we're going back to day one of this trip, let's give context to why this fear even happens. Okay, so for the sake of the story, the sake of transparency, since 2014, I have not traveled to America without a huge sense of impending dread the day before and the day of travel. Now, it's not that hard to explain when the context of it is understood, but it's something that's going to stay with me for a long time and I'm aware of it. So it's just a part of travel at this stage as far as I'm concerned. Now, I do remember I used to always be afraid when I was younger of somebody dying when I was traveling abroad. No idea why. My mom used to always say to me that no matter where you are in the world, you'll always be able to get home. You're always roughly 24 hours away from travel, from getting home. You're not going to miss a funeral. You're not going to miss a wake. If somebody dies, we can get you home and that's going to be no problem at all. Now, the thing that I can't remember, and I would love to be able to ask her, is if I had that anxiety before or after January 2014, which is where I think a lot of this would stem from to begin with. So the day before I flew to the Europeans in 2014, my mom had a brain hemorrhage. Woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning and she was fine, but by 6 o'clock was shouting for my brother to ring an ambulance. And I can't really remember much of the morning in question, but my sister does remember it. And she told me recently about how I stayed upstairs with her, because she was much younger at the time. I think would have been maybe 12 or 13, going on 14. I think she would have been 13. And I sat with her in her room when the ambulance came and took my mum away, who was in a severe amount of pain at this point. And my dad remembers how it was me that rung him, who was working abroad at the time, to tell him what had happened. And he flew home straight away that day as quick as he could. Now, I can remember we made our way to the hospital. And then for some reason in Drogheda, I then decided I would go to college anyway in Ballyfermot, maybe to get away from the situation. So I got the Matthews bus up, got into Ballyfermot late, was in college for a few hours, told my friends what had happened, then got a phone call from my uncle, who thought it would be best at the time that I come back to the hospital in case something happens, in case they say, look, she's not going to make it, she's about to die, do you want to say goodbye, blah, blah, blah. So I do remember that part of the day very clearly, being looked after in college by my friends, Clodagh, Alana and Lisa, who drove me into the Matthews bus stop, and I got the bus back to Drogheda, went to the hospital. So within the next couple of hours of all of that happening, my mam had regained consciousness. Now, she wasn't out of the woods by any means, but she was conscious and she was able to communicate. And the first thing that she told me when I was allowed in to go and see her was that I would still be flying to Lisbon the next morning for the Europeans. And I think maybe being younger and immature and naive, I was like, oh, she told me to go, it's fine. So I went. And me and a handful of people from Team Tara's went off. And I'm not sure if I wasn't aware, like I said, of the severity of what was going on, or if I was just happy to be in my own bubble and to be away from the situation. But it was a pretty crap couple of days in Lisbon anyway. But I remember I was competing on the Friday, and I was in the venue in my gi, heading down towards the bullpen, and I got a phone call from my uncle. And I remember getting the call and thinking, am I about to be told that my mom is dead? Instead, it was him saying to me not to worry, that the doctors have said that she's out of any immediate danger, is going to have a very large recovery, and it's going to be very hard, but she's not at risk of anything happening to her now, maybe in terms of a stroke or a second hemorrhage or a worse stroke than what she had had. Now, that's something that, now that she actually has died, however many years later, I realized that we got like nine and a half extra years of life out of our mom. And she had told us, or yeah, I'm not sure who had told us, but her scan and her hemorrhage and her brain is still used, I think, in Bowmont and in different places to show trainee doctors and different people dealing with hemorrhages what the treatment and protocols are for something as severe and what can be recovered from despite it being as severe as it was. So after getting that phone call, I ended up getting disqualified for entering into a knee bar position. I had no idea what a knee bar was at the time, but I don't think I've ever been as happy with a loss in a jiu-jitsu tournament in my life, because in the bigger scale of things, I didn't lose the first round and my mom didn't die on the same day in the space of an hour. So it was definitely a bright side to that particular day. So for whatever reason, and I do attribute a lot down to that sort of feeling of going away and not knowing if someone was going to die or not, anytime I've had a long haul trip to America from that point on, between covering MMA events on a shoestring budget or different stuff like that, I've always had an anxiety and an apprehension about those trips of going away for longer and being further away from home for longer. And one particular podcast listener, very good friend of mine, helped me out on Tuesday morning to no end with a, let's detach ourselves from the current emotional state that you're feeling and let's think of the pros and cons of if you go and if you don't go, because there's benefits for going and there's benefits for not going. So let's run through them here and figure out what the best way is. I'd say within 5 minutes of the phone call happening with them, like, even though we were on the phone for like 10 or 15 minutes, I was like, yeah, I'm going here. I'm locked in. We're going to Vegas one way or another. Shout out then to Aaron. Pulled a miracle in the shop. Sorted me out with something to be able to use while I was over here. My dad dropped me up to the airport. All of this hassle avoided. Quickest trip through security and US pre-clearance in history. The emptiest that I've ever seen either of them. Only 95 people on the direct flight from Dublin to Vegas with Aer Lingus, brand new route running from October to May, I have been told. Tuesday, Thursday and Saturday direct flights. For all of your information, you can visit aerlingus.com. I was nicely set up for a trip in premium economy, which, as those of you know, is a row of four seats all to yourself in economy. But a couple of minutes after takeoff, I may do the lotto when I go home, I was called out by one of the staff, and it turns out they took an extreme sympathy of the state of me, the hack of me, and give me a slightly better seat further up towards the top of the plane. That's all I'm going to say on the matter. It was an unbelievable gesture from Aer Lingus, and I am absolutely buzzing with it. All I'll say is it turns out that consistently above average is enjoyed and appreciated by Aer Lingus staff, both from the top to the bottom of the chain. And what a world we live in. What a flipping world we live in. The meal was great. The bed was great. Everything about it was amazing. Absolutely delighted. Thank you very much to my guardian angels in Aer Lingus. I owe you all a lot of goodwill and gestures. So, we made it to Vegas. We land in Las Vegas, see the sign, go down the carousel, get to the Uber, head off to the world-renowned Mardi Gras Hotel and Casino near the Strip, which should probably be in a very, have a huge asterisk next to it, as it is not near the Strip in a walking sense. Going to use those words loosely. I'm also going to use the words loosely, hotel and casino. But look, don't judge the reviews. Just don't judge the reviews. Like, very small casino and more like a motel, but we did get a decent room. And you know what? It's been grand. It's actually been great. The beds are very comfortable. The showers are roasting. It's been clean. It's been perfect. Do you know what I mean? And it's been incredibly affordable. So although I was very skeptical and nervous about coming here by myself initially at the start until John got here, would probably stay here again next year. Would probably throw myself back into the Mardi Gras this time next year as well. In terms of the reviews, like, yeah, recent break-ins, recent credit card scams, whatever. I think that's just because you can get into the hotel from the street. You don't have to, like, walk through the casino. And I think if you had one of the ground floor rooms that were facing the car park outside of the premises, that would be the one you'd be more worried about being kicked in. Then again, last night, 2 o'clock in the middle of the night, up typing away on the laptop, John watching stuff on his phone, the door was nearly kicked in. And I was like, what do you want? That's the voice that I put on. I said, what do you want? When I heard someone kick the door in. And then they like realized it was the wrong room, so they went upstairs and they were looking for somebody upstairs. Spent a few minutes in the apartment above us, and then we heard them leaving rapidly down the stairs into a speeding car. So, who knows? So, day number two, I was here by myself anyway for the first night. Not a great sleep, it has to be said, but that was just out of worry of the lock of the door being kicked in as well. Day number two, met up with Chris and Adam Letty, who are staying just down the road from us in an Airbnb. Headed off to 10th Planet Las Vegas. I was initially unsure about training that close to the tournament, but afterwards, I have to say, I felt such a huge benefit from it. Loads of people dropping in for the Nogi Worlds. Top athletes, world champions, very well respected and known gyms and athletes all on the same mat, which was insane. I got plenty of good rounds in with people from that gym and got to chat with the owner, who's an absolute gent. Really nice guy called Casey, and they have a lot of good students. Got to train with a lot of their blue, purple and brown belts. Wanted to try and roll with as many of them as possible in terms of like training with the person who is also getting ready to compete, if that makes sense. Not going to name drop either. Got to roll with an elite black belt, former world champion. Got to roll with him 2 days in a row. It was unreal experience. Have looked up to, studied and admired his game for a lot of years. So to be able to train with him was an absolute treat. And while that is a bit of a sit back and appreciate how far you've come moment in terms of studying and being a fan of somebody as a blue and purple belt, to then being able to train with them several years later, just even the ability to be able to drop into a gym a few days before the World Championships, not roll at an insane pace, but get a good sweat on so you don't get injured, rolling with complete strangers, trying to work your competition game, not working at competition intensity, and taking into consideration that, like, maybe being at a black belt level, I'm able to keep myself a little bit safer than usual when rolling with lower belts. But without a doubt, between that day and we went the next day as well. Much less intense session the next day. Focused on keeping the weight as low as possible so I could have as good of a dinner as possible. Definitely one of the top gym drop-in experiences that I've ever had traveling. Really, really, really great. And we'll definitely be back there for Nogi Worlds next year. Headed back to the venue the following day as well, or that day, the second day we were training, because there was matches on and stuff like that. The venue is an insane setup. The scale of it is unlike anything anyone in Ireland would have ever experienced. I think it's something like 18 to 19 mats that are running at one time, including two huge mats in the middle. It's like a huge hall in a convention center. But as I said on an earlier episode, the convention center in itself is so ginormous that the Jiu-Jitsu World Championships are in a unit in the convention center, whereas Cowboy Christmas has taken over the entire South Hall of the convention center. Now, Cowboy Christmas, as we spoke about before, is an enigma in itself. I got to go all around it this year. It's unbelievable. Like, I sat talking to a fella called Owen from California who owns a infused olive oil and balsamic vinegar company. And we chatted shop about the balsamic industry for a little while. He gave me a few tasters. Unbelievable. Have his business card. I would have bought several bottles, only I don't have a checked bag and it would have got taken off me at the airport. This is one of the single greatest fumbles of my life. But I have his card. I might consider a little bit of online ordering. If not, I'll be bringing a checked bag this time next year to rinse this man of his balsamic collection. And it means that his aged balsamics will be aged a little one more year. So this is a very much a win-win situation. If we dip back to the day before the tournament, I felt myself getting a little bit more agitated and nervous about the following day. I think that there's always going to be a part of just wanting to get your matches going. It's one of the harder parts of multiple day tournaments in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, where you're around the venue for long periods. And really, you just want to be there for yourself. You just want to compete. You just want to get it done. The jet lag that I was going through during the week, probably the worst that it's ever been. Waking up at like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, finding it very hard to get back to sleep. On the day that I was competing, I fell asleep at 8 o'clock the night before, which was an absolute rookie mistake. Woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning, dozed back off until about 4:15, and then I was awake from that point on. I went, got a coffee in the hotel bar, and that was a grim experience on top of it as well. And I know that I've talked about this sort of stuff before, but for a place that is projected as such a bright light, amusing location, there's a really saddening, humanized side to Las Vegas that you see during those dead hours. People living rough on streets, pushing carts, derelict apartments, derelict housing, derelict parking lots with like villages and stuff set up. People struggling with addiction issues, both inside and outside of the casinos. And I'm not here to preach. I don't believe in the slightest that anyone on the planet should be like sober or teetotal. But I am aware that addiction can take a slightly stronger grip of you depending on your situation or your mental state. And having been in the situation before where I've been in a place like this as I tap the table, if you can hear that, like the table that I would have been sitting at in the Hooters Casino, trying to grind up as much weed as possible, trying to get the last of your joints in before you leave here, and not wanting to leave it here and feeling like so attached to it and stuff like that. Whew. Seeing other people seemingly struggle at 4 o'clock in the morning in a hotel casino lobby, playing slot machines or whatever, it's something I'm more aware of when I look around the place here, and my heart goes out a little bit to those people at the same time. So fast forward to a couple of hours, because I lay in bed then just looking at the roof for a while. We headed off to the venue because John had his absolute matches up first, and then I had to go and get warm for myself. So I know what worked for me here last year, so I wanted to try and simulate that as much as possible. Now, in the ideal situation, for me, I always want someone to roll with for a few rounds. I didn't have that, so I stuck the headphones on, threw my tracksuit bottoms and hoodie on over my clothes, went in the convention center hallway on the carpets and just started jogging. Jogging for a few minutes, then doing sprints between the pillars, a little bit of hopping, a little bit of skipping, a little bit of sprints on the spot, staying away from the bullpen for as long as possible just so I could get a proper sweat on so that my first burst of energy came from before I competed. So eventually I go to the bullpen. Maybe, unfortunately, my opponent was late. Either he was late or he was playing the exact same game that I was playing. So I was hanging around the bullpen for longer than expected. And I was thinking, oh, this guy's going to be disqualified. And I'm going to be straight into the match against the high-ranked guy. And I'm going to be going in against him cold. Now, from a nervous perspective, I did want to take it one match at a time. Getting that energy out early is very important, I think, in your first match. Thankfully, he showed up before he got disqualified. And I knew my first match was going to be on. So I won the guard pull. Was working off open guard. Felt I had a really nice bite on a guillotine early that I used to sweep to top. Having watched it back now, I didn't realize that I did basically a headstand on my neck at one point in the guillotine. And I think I thought at the time that I was a lot closer to landing into the mount when I took the top position. But I still hung on to the neck maybe for just a second too long. So I used the guillotine to get the sweep. And then I let go of the head without being prepared for the next situation. He reacted quicker than I did and got back to a guard and straight away threw a shoulder clamp, like a shoulder lock on me, which he ended up nearly sweeping straight back to mount. But I also panicked and tried to pull out of the position a little bit. So I gave that 2 points back straight away. A tight enough match from that point on. I nearly swept to mount again with a shoulder crunch of my own, but I ended up winning the match by an advantage. And I will admit that I felt safe for the last 90 seconds or so, was a bit afraid of opening up from that point to not concede any needless advantage scores that he might have gotten to level the match up, and that he would have had the urgency and need to try and get the score back. So that being said, winning matches at this level, I've said it before, is something that I won't take for granted. First match nerves are definitely a real thing, so getting the full 6 minutes was definitely good and able to recover. My second match was then delayed because my opponent was at the other side of the venue receiving an award from the IBJJF for being the number two ranked Master 1 competitor for the calendar year of 2024. So all weights from rooster weight to ultra heavy, this lad had the second most points out of everyone. Multiple absolute titles throughout the year, gi and no gi. When I heard his name being called out for that award, I laughed. And I was, admittedly, I was nervous about competing against him. My reality for the tournament when I saw the bracket was that this guy is probably going to be able to tech me and be able to beat me. But as long as I didn't get emptied fast and submitted fast and I could feel what he was best at, then I would be happy with the experience of competing against him to see where I am. Now, I am being stared at right across from where I am right now. John Luca has just arrived back into the apartment. He is double bicep curling a packet of peanut butter and chocolate Oreos. So let's get back into the script here and try and ignore him. He's probably shaking his head at what I'm saying actually at the same time. But as long as I didn't get submitted fast and I could see what he was good at, then I'd be happy with the experience. Now, I'm going to say that now. I wouldn't have verbalized that beforehand, because if you start verbalizing that beforehand, then you're going to get smoked and that's how it is. The reality is that when you're there and you know that your match is next, you really do start to believe that you're capable of an upset and that you're going to stick an L on them, right? You know what your best moves are. You know that it's just going to be a match. You know that they're probably nervous as well. And if you get anyone in the position that you're best at, you're going to have the chance to beat them. So the guy ended up being very strong, good solid passer, great top pressure and positioning. He passed to mount, which got him 7-0 up pretty quickly. Passed again after I recovered. Into like a three-quarter guard. Then he got to knee on belly, and before I knew it, I was like 12 or 15 points down. Now, within the second half of the match, I was able to connect my guard, get underneath him, off-balance him, and I hit a mental block in decision-making of not trying to sweep to come up on top from the off-balance position, because I knew that there was such a deficit on points that if I get up on top and he pulls me into close guard, that's going to be the end of the match. So I would have to try and submit him from the bottom. I feel like I didn't give my best effort in terms of transitioning into a knee bar or toe hold attempt to try and work towards getting his back and finishing him. And if I was going to change the match in any meaningful way, I knew it would have to be like a clutch submission out of nowhere. So on his last guard pass on me with about 45 seconds left, he swapped into scarf control, and without wanting to give up or submit or just let the match finish in that position, I knew that I would have one chance to reverse the situation. I would either be able to reverse the scarf hold by moving out to the left, using my legs to throw in front of his head, and if I could get him onto his back, I could try attack a Kimura or just try and squeeze the life out of his head with a submission that's known as the James Bond, which is a little bit of a meme submission, to be honest. Or if he tried to move from the scarf hold into the knee on belly again, then I could throw up a short armbar from the bottom, which is one of my favorite submissions, which he ended up going for. I was able to lock the arm on, sweep him from the bottom position, come up on top, and I finished the match attacking an armbar. Now, I've watched this clip many times since then because I panicked once I ended up getting to the top position, just losing focus slightly. I should have swapped from my left arm dominant on the armbar to my right arm dominant in the armbar, and then use my left arm from the outside to break the grip and then try and break his arm. Now, I knew I was going to have to break it or make him verbally tap with how little time was left on the clock and considering how many points he was up. By the time I did swap to left hand to right hand dominant to try and break with my left hand to the strong side, I felt the connection of his arm weaken. I used my leg against his armpit. I felt the arm torque and his grip was starting to go. I ended up in a really strong position where 5 more seconds would have gotten me closer to the finish. It's my best submission, and I knew I would have hit it. 5 more seconds to break the grip, minimum, take into account for needing 5 to 10 seconds more for breaking the actual arm. And this guy is a multiple-time world European champion, ADCC qualifier, number 2 pound-for-pound ranked in the world for this year, dogged me about the place for a couple of minutes. And with a few more seconds at the end of the match, I'm sitting here recording the most insufferable podcast on the planet about how I took this lad out, schooled him, and then probably lost out in a medal by something hilarious, 2 points in the next round and bottle it. That's probably what the podcast would have turned out to be if I had have submitted that man. From looking for a way out to not making the trip, pouring Pepsi all over my phone, leaving Las Vegas with a higher sense of belief in the level that I have in jiu-jitsu is worth its weight in gold from a mental and an athletic developmental perspective. So as we gear up towards the end of this trip, the end of this podcast, I have a huge shout of appreciation to the likes of John Luca, who's just after walking in here, even if we have been fighting all week, and I am never, ever, 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 ever sharing a bedroom with him again as long as I live. What do you think of that? What do you think of that? Go on.
Go fuck yourself.
From the likes of himself to the likes of Chris and Adam Letty, Zara, Sam, Emily from Brew, Sam and Emily from Brew, they were there. Gareth and John were there as well, hung around for my matches and cheering me on. Sam and Chris in particular, two people who I get along with over the course of knowing them for many years in the Irish Jiu-Jitsu community. I have a huge amount of respect for both of them in terms of competitors or their respective schools and gym owners and businesses, what they've been able to produce as athletes. At the end of the day, and we've talked about this before on the podcast, there can be people who will compete against each other in Ireland domestically or have students who will compete against each other a lot. But when it comes down to stuff like this, we're abroad in Las Vegas. We've all put the same risk down. We've put the money down. We've traveled thousands of kilometers to compete. Chris had a very hard match against a legend of the sport. Sam took bronze in the adult featherweight division. Chris's student Zara took silver at brown belt after winning Nogi Europeans a couple of months ago. Homegrown in Bray from day one under Chris and Adam, and they're all confident that such a young athlete like Zara is going to go on to great things at the international black belt level. I cannot imagine what that must feel like as a coach to see your student who grew to love jiu-jitsu in your academy, in your environment, go after jiu-jitsu in a full-time capacity. Like, it's an under-talked about thing, but for an athlete to get that far, they have to first love jiu-jitsu and they have to want to keep doing jiu-jitsu. And the way that they're going to keep doing that is thanks to the environment and community that is created and fostered within a gym. So let's think about that for a minute before we finish it, because I had a chat with people this morning about how jiu-jitsu in America is a lot more commercialized. It's a lot more like a service, where in Ireland, we consider it more of a community. There's no cancellation fees in Ireland, high contracts, minimum commitments, underhand marketing techniques, tactics that are rife in other sports or communities around the country, in Ireland and the world. When we see someone come in to start, We're passionate about this sport. We only want them to enjoy it. The number one thing is that we want the new person to enjoy this weird little sport that we think everyone should do. So if they enjoy it and they stick at it, then someone new is doing jiu-jitsu and they're enjoying it, and that's growing the sport. That is the goal. Not signing them up to a direct debit for years, not charging them for promotions, not saying you can only train here if you buy our gear and it's going to cost this amount of money. We want them to end up enjoying the sport, and then they will enjoy it and stay because of the atmosphere and the community that is created within these gyms. So if you get someone in from a young age, and that's the whole perspective that makes them enjoy the sport and want to compete, make jiu-jitsu their life, make it their goal, develop themselves and takes it more seriously, then in my opinion, that is an unbelievable thing all around. So flying to New York tonight, delighted to see my mates tomorrow for a couple of hours before flying back home into Ireland from JFK. What a treat. I've got a huge elaborate sized can of Coke here beside me. We don't do these ones in Ireland, John, the 473 milliliter bottles, cans. We've got some fruit punch Gatorade here. We've got some chocolate peanut butter pie Oreo cookies here. We've got chocolate brownie Clif protein bars. We got In-N-Out burger last night. We got some white Reese's peanut butter cups. And it's just been a tremendous thing altogether, guys. But if we drop the accent for a minute and we take it a little bit more seriously, going to the airport tomorrow, flying back to Ireland at Christmas, is one of my favorite things imaginable. I have friends who come home for Christmas. It's my job to collect them from the airport at Christmas. I will go up an hour and a half early before they land so I can just sit in the airport and take in all the wholesome people crying, camera crews, whatever, about people coming home for Christmas. It's something that I love about airports. What a strange sentence to close the podcast with. Something I love about airports at Christmas. And it's also something that I love flying home from America with my new friends at Aer Lingus. America is a little bit mental. It's different for us. Culturally, it's very different from Ireland. So when you're in the airport, you're surrounded by all these people, international hubs going away to mad places. You see the Aer Lingus name, you see the logo, you see the green outfits, whatever you think yourself, you're essentially being minded in the sky by a group of Irish mammies who are taking you home. There's something much more reassuring from a holistic perspective that you're not getting on a Delta Airlines or American Airlines transatlantic flight to Dublin, Ireland. You're getting onto an Aer Lingus flight to Ireland. That's what you're getting onto. And they're looking after you. They're bringing you home. They're Irish people heading home themselves too. I don't know. I might be waffling here. There could be a longer detail in that. There could be a better story. Let me know if you feel the same affinity for flying home to Ireland on an Irish-based airline. I could be going insane. 5 days stuck in this hotel, this cracked-down hotel. I can't wait to see the lads in New York. I can't wait to get back home on Monday morning, fly down the motorway, grab a sausage and bacon bap off Eamon. It's going to be unbelievable. All going to plan. I'll be making the 12 o'clock gi class in Uri on Monday. Thank you for tuning in. Another episode in the books, consistently above average. The Las Vegas edition is done. Good luck.